You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
I got stuff for you.
Holy moly.
I need to get some snakes and release them around my house.
But they love eating people. I love eating kids.
These guys are the scientists of the supernatural, lecturers leaving lessons for inquiring laymen. They are applying the scientific method to a world that baffles science. They are the cryptids of the corn.
Every day that you open your mouth,
I know, right?
I'm more convinced that you're abducted by aliens.
No.
And it just stood up. I mean, it just like kept going and going. And she goes, what the?
These are idiots.
I was laughing reading this because I already knew how you would feel.
Idiot. What part of the story fits your balloon?
Well,
this isn't a UFO. Yeah.
But who else has big black wings and red eyes?
Batman.
Well, Mothman.
Oh, yeah, Mothman.
Well, everyone, I think we know exactly what it is. So say it all with me. It was the Sandhill Crane.
Would you try it?
No.
You wouldn't eat it?
No.
Why?
Because they're probably toxic.
There'd be a lot of poop in my pants. Seeing a 6-foot alligator go swinging through the air and slam into a tree.
Welcome back to Cryptids of the Corn Podcast. I am the great and powerful Mr. E.
And I'm J-Clone 26.
Unrehearsed and here to have fun.
That's right.
Oh my gosh. Everybody didn't know. Oh, nobody knows. I've been sick all day. Migraine stuff. And Emily should be walking in the door any minute to take the baby. So if Mr. E disappears for a minute, it's to go handle babies.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, but, you know, just in case, just because of that, in case I have to leave, we scheduled a really, really amazing guest. A man that's been just in the field forever doing amazing work. Jay, why don't you give him a good introduction?
Well, he has been investigating the stuff of nightmares for over 30 years. He has investigated the things that go bump in the night and meticulously researched the historical and psychological contexts of myths and legends from around the world. He seeks to uncover the archetypal precedent for the monsters that haunt our collective thoughts. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Ron Murphy.
Woo!
Hello, gentlemen.
Ron, it's been a year and a half
of since us we were
promising
supposed to do this?
You to get on this show, so I'm so sorry it took this long.
That's okay. So I was excited because the first time I met you guys, you know, I thought, oh, I can't wait to be on your show. And then I see you again at a conference and say, hey, can I get on your show sometime? So it's been, over a year and a half. It's been a year and a half too long, let's put it that way.
I think you're correct.
And then everybody at home knows, you know, me and Emily ended up with the girls in Ronald McDonald House for 10, 11 weeks. So that slowed everything
that turned
way
everything
down.
Upside down.
So thank you finally for getting on here, Ron. It's been amazing. Before we get rocking and rolling, tell everybody a little bit about yourself. Tell them where they can get your you have a ton of books. You have all kinds of amazing stuff. Tell everybody how to contact you, where to buy your stuff, where you're going to be at, those kind of things.
Absolutely. So the best way to contact me is on social media. You can like me on Facebook, Ronald L. Murphy, Jr., Ronald L. Murphy, Jr. And I would, you know, love to interact with folks, even if you don't agree with anything that I say, because this is, you know, an open forum and we have to have debates in order to figure out what's going on. You can get my books, like everything else, on Amazon. A few of my books is being carried by Walmart now. So you can actually order some of my books through Walmart. But Amazon is the easiest way to do it. Plus, I get more royalties whenever it goes through Walmart or through Amazon, not so much Walmart.
There we go.
Buy them in person if you can. Buy them at Amazon.
Yeah, buy them in person if you can. That's right. So what's upcoming for me is I do ghost tours in my local vicinity. So I'm in Western Pennsylvania, about 30 miles outside of Pittsburgh, and I'm going to be doing a driving ghost tour this Friday and Saturday. So we're going to be looking through all the kind of weird things that happen in Derry Township here in Western Pennsylvania. And the week after that, I'll be doing a tour of historic Blairsville, Pennsylvania, the town that I grew up in. And on Halloween Day, I'll be giving a final walking tour of Derry, Pennsylvania. And if anybody has any questions about Derry, Pennsylvania, feel free to look at Small Town Monsters. Invasion of the Chestnut Ridge features Derry in it very heavily. And also a series that I did with Small Town Monsters called Sasquatch Uncovered, The Ridge, which also the Chestnut Ridge plays a pivotal part in that particular series as well.
Oh, absolutely. How long have you been doing tours?
I'm sorry, sir?
How long have you been doing tours?
About 4 years now.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, about 4 years.
Perfect time of year for that.
I used to write tours for other companies, freelance on that. And I thought, there's all this great information that I'm researching and everything like that. I might as well just do it myself. And I'm talking about, I work with historical societies in very, very small towns. Some of these towns have under 2,000 people in them. So this brings an influx of people, a much needed influx of people into these small little rural towns. And, they were once prosperous back in the time of the railroads and coal mining and everything. Mm-hmm. And they've kind of had their Labor Day come and go. But I want to at least remember the way these towns used to be. And nothing brings history alive more than ghost, which is really kind of an oxymoron there.
Yeah, ain't it?
Yep. But no, I've always been fascinated with this area. So I grew up in a place called Blairsville. Like I said, it's about 35 miles outside of Pittsburgh. And I would listen to Stan Gordon as a kid. Stan Gordon is kind of like the grandfather of all things paranormal here in Pennsylvania. And, he would talk about all these haunted locations and, Bigfoot sightings and UFO crashes and everything. And then my mother would take my brother and I out, and we would go do investigations on our own. So it was always around the Chestnut Ridge, because the Chestnut Ridge, even now, I can see it right out of my window. So for most of my life, I've always been in the vicinity of the Chestnut Ridge. That's where I've done my research, and I feel very comfortable there. And I'm also lucky because since the 1970s, the Chestnut Ridge has been called the Twilight Zone of Pennsylvania. So a lot of strange things do occur up there. So as a researcher, you're never running out of things to look for.
That's nice. In your own backyard, even. It makes it even better.
My own. And you know what? The other thing is, too, I don't have to camp. I have a love-hate relationship with camping. I would love to be a camper, but I'm not good at it. Like, I'm talking about, like, I've caught a mountain pie maker on fire before. I didn't even know you could do that. But I'm not good at it. I'm not good over, like, following directions and putting up a tent and everything like that. So whenever I investigate the Chestnut Ridge, I get to come home that night, right? I get a home-cooked meal. I get to sleep in a bed and everything. So that's really one of the reasons why I stick around here.
I'm sure you're not going to run out of stuff in the Chestnut Ridge area to research, but that is a good reason. I used to survival camp.
Yeah, that's right.
I used to survival camp as a youth, where, like, literally we'd have to build our own shelter and all that. Now I sleep in the bus and in the pull-out couch. I don't do any of the camp and stuff anymore. The tent, the air mattress, we tent camp. The air mattress in the tent is better than the bed I sleep on in the house. So.
Yeah, sure. And whenever I grow up, I do want to be like you guys, because you have everything together. we've met each other twice, and I really like the way you guys roll.
Oh, I mean, it helps that there's two of us. You have a bajillion kids that help you out, but they don't get to go to everything. But, me and Jay are always normally together.
you know, we complete each other.
That's right.
When it comes to things, because I think we're both very scatterbrained or
very different
and organized, but in different ways.
Very different ways.
Yeah, because we met you. I was going to say we met you at Squonkapalooza 2 years ago, or I guess a year and a half now
That's
ago.
Right.
Two
Squonks ago, and now Squonk this year, which also is, you know, Pennsylvania, small town America, a lot of history there.
Oh, Johnstown, yeah.
So very fitting that, we met in that way.
History.
Yeah.
A place with high history.
Mm-hmm.
And we both share a daughter named Winter.
Is that it?
Oh, no. I have a daughter named Willow.
The other one.
Say, that didn't sound right. Yeah.
Willow.
Willow, yes.
Both
W's. That's right.
No, I couldn't remember. And then I was grandmother and kids giving them goodies and pop at the festival. Jay always calls me mother hen.
Well, I wanted to let you know, I did the Albatwitch Festival 2 weekends ago, and the organizer of the Squonk Fest was there. He spoke very highly of you two, and he's hoping you're going to come back again this year.
Absolutely. I think so. As long as the schedule allows it.
As long as the date works out, we're not going to miss Squonk.
Right, yeah. It's a staple now.
So, yeah. Right now, it's tentatively scheduled for August the 2nd.
2025. Mark your calendar at home.
There you go. Squonk's one you don't want to miss. It's a lot of fun.
Right. So that's the reason I brought it up. I think that any of your listeners would find it very enjoyable to make that as part of their vacation. It's a beautiful area, historic Johnstown, Pennsylvania. You can go to the Flood Museum. You can take the inclines up the mountainside. You can do a lot of things there, plus go to the Squonk Festival. So I hope a lot of people do come out to see it.
Oh, yeah. It's one of those that's definitely worth it. The people that put it on are great. The town's great. Like you said, we're from a small rural town, too. I mean, if we were lucky enough to have a college, and you can ask the town people whether we're lucky or not to have it.
It's a double-edged sword.
You're right. But without it, I mean, financially, there'd be nothing in this town.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's 100 little towns in Northwest Ohio that would we be the same as,
Right.
Everybody would have left by now. Everybody's kids would have moved away. Like the towns, actually, most of them, they average 300 or 400 people. We're at 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're pretty lucky in that aspect that a lot of people, you can still stay here. But with the Chestnut, have you ever written a book on the Chestnut Ridge incident, or is it included in any of your works?
Yeah, the first book that I ever wrote was called The Unexplained World of the Chestnut Ridge, what had to do with years of my research. So the first foray into me being an author was documenting my research on the Chestnut Ridge.
Oh, what awesome!
The thing about the Chestnut.
Oh, sorry. I was going to ask that started about 30 years ago, roughly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My research. Okay. So again, ever since I've been a kid, I've been really, enthralled by the myths, the legends, the folklore of this area, because this is part of Appalachia, right? So we always have our own kind of little quirks and eccentricities and everything like that around here. But I've always been enamored by the tall tales, and especially Bigfoot, but as a researcher, I waited till I get some education under my belt, and then I can look at all this stuff through the lens of linguistics and psychology and sociology, and kind of see if we can make a little bit clearer focus about what is going on. There's a lot of people out there, the boots on the ground people, which we definitely do need. They go out there and bang on trees and do hoops and howls and all that kind of stuff, which is great. Again, I'm not denigrating them in any way. But whenever they write books, it's usually a litany of sightings, right? And this is great for documentation.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the kind of research that I do is I want to make sure that all the dots are connected. So if there's something going on now, people are seeing something now, we don't exist in a vacuum. So there had to be precedent there. So I'm trying to see how far we can go back with these sightings, with what people are experiencing. And if we can connect the dots and see if it makes sense on a worldwide view. And sometimes it does. Sometimes we see the archetype of the wild man that looks, it's our Bigfoot, our Sasquatch. In China, it's the Yeren. In Australia, it's the Yowie, the Almasty in Russia. So we see a connection with, yep. You know, to borrow a term from Carl Jung, the idea of the phone threw me off. Hold on. Yeah, so
believe me, it's fine.
I completely lost my train of thought.
But anyway,
to borrow from Carl Jung,
yeah,
he believed that, you know, we have a collective unconscious, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these symbols that are interrelated among cultures around the world are the archetypes. So the idea of an archetype is very important to me. And you see that whenever you look at werewolves and vampires and ghosts, they interact in very similar ways across time and space. And that leads me to believe that there is something out there responsible for this on a universal level. I say this a lot. You know, these things that we call cryptids and these things that we call the paranormal are embroidered into our DNA. They mean something to us and we mean something to them. And it's that kind of symbiotic relationship, right? They feed off of our fear and in turn, they make us more human. You know, we don't have that hubris anymore. We don't know everything there is to know out there. These creatures still, you know, confront us and say there are wild places and there are uncivilized spaces. And whatever is in your science books is not the complete picture about what's going on. And that's really what keeps me going. I look at the world very wide-eyed, you know, almost childlike because, you know, I started to get into this whenever I was a child. So I really do think that there are more things out there than what we know, right? Just because science hasn't cataloged it doesn't mean it's not there.
100%.
Yeah.
As a man that worked with endangered species, I can agree. And I wish more people thought like you did. 100%. And by the way, everybody at home, I just bought the book. That's what I was doing now? On Amazon. I just bought it. Because I needed it.
Yeah. Because I mean, I really like all the, you know, the archetypal stuff. I don't know like too much specifically about them, you know, but I know they exist. I know a little bit about it, but I never really drew that connection, you know, when talking about cryptids. But I like everything you just explained there, you know, them feeding off our fear, that symbiotic relationship we kind of have with them. And at the same time, you know, more than half of us, I'm almost sure, don't even believe these things still exist.
That's right. Right. So that's another good point, right? And what I would say in defense of the cryptids and the paranormal is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you do not believe it. It's still part of our culture, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I often say as well, too, I think the forest in our minds, that gray matter wilderness between our ears, is just as fascinating as, you know, the forest in which we encounter these creatures. There is a depth to these things that is not simply corporeal. You know, there's.
But I love what he's saying about the connection. I wanted to say something. What we talk about, that's one thing we love with doing with our show, is talking about the places. Humans have this idea that we know everything, that it's all explored. As a guy that worked in many fields of science, and I've known scientists on both sides of it. You know, scientists as an individual, they don't. You can find ones that agree and disagree, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still so much of the world unexplored. Our Australian rainforest episode is probably my favorite to point at and be like, just look, the three of the five largest rainforests in the world have had almost no research done on them.
Because
every animal, insect, and plant is either poisonous or venomous.
Or trying to kill you.
And it's you're 3 hours away from a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the biggest thing, you know, the inland taipan and the coastal taipan, the one that'll bite you is less venomous. The one that won't bite you will kill you. You know, and then a guy just in the States just got bit by an inland taipan in a collection. Not good. But just to show like that in the Yukon and the Siberia and all these places, and you don't have to go to those places for hidden wilderness. I mean, here in the States, we have plenty of stuff you can go to. Mad River area, or not Mad River, sorry, Mohican.
There you go.
Mohican and Hocking have valleys that don't have people in them. Salt Fork, is famous for a couple big valleys that no people go, and you have to hike over two hills. We call them mountains in Ohio, but they are not.
They're Ohio mountains.
They're Ohio mountains. For Flatlanders, it's a lot. It's a lot, you know. They're steep. But there are these areas, even next to civilization, that are very little researched, understood, or even looked into.
Exactly. I do a lot of stuff in West Virginia as well, too. And, you know, West Virginia is very inhospitable. There's places there that I'm sure, like around the New River Gorge, I'm sure there's places around there that people never set a foot into because it is just not conducive for humans to go into.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, it's not great. I mean.
And there's people that do live there that you're never going to see.
100%. I mean, Louisiana, I've been out, you know, pretty far out. And they talk about ivory-billed woodpeckers, Louisiana, Arkansas, and the swamps and stuff. There are people that live out there, but you're never going to see them. Mm-hmm. And it sucks to be there if you're not used to it.
Right, yeah.
It's driving through soup with soup-filled mosquitoes. It just isn't
great. That's right. Well, yeah, and think of the Everglades as well, too. Mm-hmm. At one time, there was indigenous populations that lived in the Everglades, and they were able to withstand everything that's down there. But, you know, we are really spoiled. Like we have, electricity and we hide behind walls and all that stuff. And everything's out there is pretty, except the things that bite us and then we kill them. But, one of the things that I bring up whenever I talk about the squonk is that one time in Pennsylvania, there were, woodland bison here, and there were indigenous elk in the area, wolverine, all these animals, you know, that you associate with, Yosemite National Park and the Rocky Mountains and everything. Mm-hmm. All these animals once were native to Pennsylvania, the mountain lion, the wolf. And we as human beings decided that just didn't work for us. So we went in there and we systematically destroyed these things. Mm-hmm. What these wild places tell us, or whenever these creatures show up, whether it be, like you said, the ivory-billed woodpecker or something that's out of place, like a wolf or a mountain lion or whatever, it shows you that nature doesn't adhere to humanity's rules. There's much more out there than just what we say can happen and cannot happen. We've domesticated so much, but there's always going to be a wildness out there that we're never able to take control of. And out of that wildness, I will suppose that there is the stuff of nightmares, because if we can't control it, then we fear it.
Very true.
100%, yeah.
And that amongst people, like they have that same thing with other people even. If we can't control it, or if it's out of fear, ignorance. What's the saying, fear leads to ignorance, and ignorance leads to hate and all that stuff. But it all stems from
ignorance
fear.
Ignorance leads to fear. Fear leads to hate.
And I thought it was fear first.
I think it's ignorance first. Nah. Not understanding.
Well, I think fear and
because
then...
ignorance, not, it doesn't matter. It not understanding matter. Leads
Getting
to fear.
Getting lost in the weeds here.
But not understanding leads to fear.
Well, yeah, true. Well, yeah. Okay, fair enough.
But, yeah.
Yeah. But no, I mean, this is all very pertinent, this discussion mm-hmm. that we're having. And whenever you go to conferences, and I attend a lot of conferences, and usually the speakers, the lectures are very by the book. And I was really surprised whenever you talked up in Johnstown, because your talk wasn't the by the book talk. And I always pride myself because I don't do it that way either. Again, it's great whenever we talk about Bigfoot, or we talk about any kind of cryptid or paranormal. It's okay to have, anecdotes and have some sort of precedent. Mm-hmm. But I really want to know what is going on. I don't want to know. I mean, I'm interested whenever people experience something, but what they are experiencing is the thing that really matters. You know, is it flesh and blood? Is it biological? And if it is, then it has to, fit into some sort of framework in order for it to not only exist, but for it to propagate, for it to still be out there.
100%. And that's something thank you for the compliment too, by the way. I do appreciate it. But that's, we do Bigfoot stuff. We do Dogman stuff, but we're not a Bigfoot podcast because of that. There's 100, you can go out and to Google Bigfoot podcasts. There's literally thousands of them. Go have your pick. I like the ones that, we've talked about Living Mammoth scene, and and people see weird, out of place animals. I'm like the Shoebill episode, Monster in the Marsh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the ones where a lady had seen, her name's Jen. Hi, Jen. Had seen a weird looking bird, and she described to me this bird, and she's like, it was a dinosaur at Jurassic Park in the Sandal Islands, I believe.
In Florida, right?
No, it's coastal. I don't remember the Sandal Islands are off the top of my head. But through our research and stuff, we found that hundreds of people had seen them, and they were all shoebill storks, which are rare in Africa.
Wow.
They're the most, why they are ending up here in the States is they are the most expensive trafficked bird in the world. Each one can, you know, net you around $500,000 if you can get it here to the country. There's only two in captivity on public display in the United States. But they are extremely shy. All the sightings were early morning or late evening, like right before it gets dark or right before it gets daylight. And every person seen it said, it looked like a dinosaur. It looked at me and it walked off.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them. And that's what they do. Wow. They are very, very secretive. They make, if anybody hasn't heard, well, actually the week before this, you've heard their noise.
Yeah, that's right.
So you know what they sound like. But they make ungodly sounds that you don't think of as a bird.
No, it sounds like a machine gun going off.
And that's the whole purpose of that episode was that we just did, to show you that, especially birds, but amphibians, little animals, big animals can make noises that you'd be like, well, that was Bigfoot. Well,
even small mammals.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think there was a point there somewhere. Yeah,
so what is the wingspan on a shoebill?
I think, okay, off the top of my head, I think 7 to 8 feet. Oh, no, they're shorter winged birds. So probably 6 to 7 feet for their height. They can stand up to 5 feet tall.
Oh, yes. I know that they're very, very tall animals.
So they're a wetland bird. So typically, they have shorter wingspans. Hmm. They're not giant gliders.
It says their wingspan can range from 7 feet, 7 inches to 8 feet, 6 inches.
So 7 to 8 feet.
Yeah.
Wow.
So my first guess was right.
Yeah, that's, you nailed it.
Crazy.
But I was a guess.
Yeah.
That's still good.
That's very possible what people see whenever they report thunderbirds.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Californian condor, and the one we've talked about with the Thunderbird stuff is Teratorns, which I'm sure you've heard of before, everybody at home. You know, it's an extinct, 11,000 years ago, extinct group of birds that easily, depending on who you talk to, they'd hit that 20-foot mark pretty easy, wingspans, carrying off deer and stuff like that.
Gosh.
Not related to raptors. They're more close related to scavengers like vultures, which are related to... You remember?
No.
The seagull family.
The seagulls. You're right.
If you paint a vulture white, they look just like seagulls, and nobody realizes it. But yeah, they're related to seagulls. So there were these giant, more predatory, like vulture cousins, essentially the Teratorns, just massive animals. Oh yeah, sorry. Go on, Ron.
Wow. No. Because I try to find a logical answer to people. Whenever they report seeing, you know, these strange and outlandish things.
Mm-hmm.
The Thunderbird. So I did an episode for, I think it's called, it might be Monster Files or Cryptid Files. The name changed a couple times, but my episode will be on next Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Discovery Channel. So awesome. Don't know the name of the show, but I think it's Cryptid Files. But so we will be investigating on that program the Thunderbird in western Pennsylvania in the Chestnut Ridge area. So because people report them around here, but there's really no way that a Thunderbird, especially a 20-foot wingspan, could stay hidden for very long unless it was terrestrial more than it was a flight type of bird.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see how that's possible. But I'm also of the opinion that people aren't making this stuff up either. So there's something out there that explains the sightings.
Well, I can maybe do that for you. We've talked about this a lot.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So do you know, like, vultures and why Thunderbirds, you know, they would always would talk about Native American legends of them bringing in the storms. That they would, like, they literally would talk about them dragging in the storms behind them. They're writing what's called a thermal vent. So they're literally riding this giant pillow of air that the storm's pushing, so they don't have to flap. They can fly thousands of miles without flapping. What is special in this country is we have two massive mountain ranges that have what's called current uplifts. So when you fly in across the entire Midwest, like Californian condors, they've been seen all the way out in Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, which they're truly massive birds. You know, if you see them, they just dwarf everything next to them. But what happens is when they hit Appalachia, a lot of times they just hang out for a minute and then they catch the next current and they get back up into the upper atmosphere. And then they ride that for another couple thousand miles. So that's why it's the last rest stop before you go up again. So, and we know we know that from giant gliders that exist that we have, you know, tags on and that kind of stuff. Condors, they used to do it when there was more of them. I mean, I think we're down to like 700 or 800 of them. So there's not many of them that come out this way anymore, but they're doing really good work of actually, I think they're releasing around 30 or 40 of them a year now. So they're doing pretty good work and getting them back out there. So in our lifetimes, we may see, you know, condors reaching back over this way again regularly. But yeah, so they kind of ride that vent and then get back up and then they can ride back home.
That's very, very cool. Yeah. I would never even have guessed that they would come out this far, but that's very illuminating. I like that a lot. Now, how do we explain the reports of people being picked up by these things?
So condors are not very aggressive. Sorry, we flipped the script. I guess you're interviewing me now. No, condors aren't very aggressive. But what they were famous for is a lot of white settlers would see a condor nest and say that's where a dragon lived because they'd be up in the hills and stuff like that. Because underneath these nests, there would be giant piles of bones, specifically bison. So what condors do is they'll drag a chunk of carcass back home. Their feet are really like club-like and stuff like that, but they're really big birds, so they can drag really big. And when they're done eating, they push the bones out. So after a couple of generations, you end up with a 200-foot tall slide of bones, you know, with really harmless animals. But you, from looking at it, from, you know, being a white settler and being like, I don't know what the heck that is
up there.
That's a dragon. That's what's up there. But smaller birds of prey attack humans. Harpy eagles kill people. They are great. They are designed, they are evolved to murder monkeys and apes. Bald eagles, there was that video recently of a bald eagle picking up, a four-year-old.
Yeah.
And he got this four-year-old probably 10 or 15 feet in the air before the four-year-old could struggle away enough to drop. So they don't have to be great big, massive animals. Golden eagles, you know, they'll carry off a whole deer. Not great big, huge 100-pound deer, you know, smaller deer, but now you make a bird that's 20 feet long, or 20 feet wide, I'm sorry. They can do it. I mean, that'd be easy. It's just more of like a picking up takeout.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a scavenger right. when you can just carry whatever you want back.
Right, yeah.
But even turkey vultures and stuff like that will drop prey. That's the way they kill it because they don't have the same hardware as raptors to sit there and, you know, slice right. and stuff. So even their talons aren't as sharp. So they'll just kind of get them up and carry them up and drop them. That's what happened to my mom and dad's little dog.
Oh, really?
Yeah, one before Clarice.
Wow.
They picked her up. She lived, but because she didn't die, so they didn't eat her.
Yeah.
But they would pick them up and they'd just drop them.
That's scary.
They do it with groundhogs and stuff, too.
Man, now I'm kind of scared leading our dogs out.
Your dogs are mean enough. I think they'll be okay.
The little ones?
Yeah. The one bites me constantly.
That's true.
I'm 300 pounds. If he's confident enough to come up and bite me, the vulture's going to be in trouble.
No, this is a great conversation. And this is what I like so much about these kind of forums, because it allows us to share ideas and really kind of shed light on things. I mean, it's cool to say that somebody saw a Thunderbird, but really getting to the genesis of that story is what makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, what does it mean to see a Thunderbird, you know? Like, is it a really dangerous animal? Is it a parrot? Like, I do want to ask you about that. So with these cryptids that are more fantastical, like the Enfield Horror, which shares a name with three other things. I always say it wrong.
Yeah.
The three-legged, two-armed, red-eyed guy from Indiana, right?
Yes, I think Indiana. So.
So, if and you know the story, but everybody at home, basically, you'll look it up.
I'm thinking Illinois now.
It may be Illinois. But he attacked kids, but he never got them. And the only thing he ever ate was, I believe, the back of a air conditioning unit. He ate all the guts out of an air conditioning unit.
Yeah, it was Illinois.
So is that, what do you kind of think for those kind of cryptids? Do you think they're maybe like Zeitgeist Productions? Do you think they're from somewhere else, like interdimensional, and they just kind of leak in every once in a while? Or do you think they are just native to here and they're just extremely rare?
Yeah, I think that things like that are a chimera, you know, almost like the Jersey Devil. I think they're conflated with different other creatures until you come out with this kind of monstrous myth that takes on a life of its own in people's minds. But it really, because you're talking about the Van Meter Monster. Is that what we're talking about?
No, Enfield Horror.
Enfield Horror, yeah.
Enfield. Enfield Horror.
There you go. There you go.
Enfield Horror.
Yeah.
Green, that's probably, it's not a very big one. It's just like, imagine like a little, like a chupacabra with an extra leg. An old Puerto Rican chupacabra with an extra leg.
That's pretty good.
Gotcha. Well, it's like, you know, the Van Meter Monster was similar to that too, right? It had, you know, aspects of a bird and like a, you know, something glowing as well too.
Right, yeah.
So it was a very strange creature as well too, yeah.
So you're more...
Yeah, but...
Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say that whenever you mentioned the chupacabra, as a researcher, that's a fascinating cryptid to follow because we can see in real time how it's evolving from one particular entity into something entirely different.
Yes. Yeah, we did episodes on it. The Puerto Rican chupacabra was not a blue dog.
No, very different.
That's right. That's right.
Nobody's seen a blue dog. They've seen hundreds of different things they called a chupacabra.
But it wasn't
in
a blue
Puerto
dog.
Rico, but not one of them was a blue dog.
Yeah, I wonder how that even
came out.
With the same name and everything.
With the bloodsucker, because it was like, literally, we talked about it in the episode, it was literally like the year after in Mexico, they started having problems, and they said, the chupacabra jumped from Puerto Rico to Mexico.
Game of telephone.
It is. It's just the same name.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a little bit lazy, I think. You know, come up with a new name, guys.
Well, Zelato dog or blue dog doesn't sound, because in Mexico, they have Zelato dogs. They actually breed hairless blue dogs. I believe it was the Maya.
Oh gosh,
I always get it wrong. Yeah. But I think it was the Maya that bred them because the Maya bred Chihuahuas and they bred Zelato dogs.
And they treated Chihuahuas really well.
Yeah, no, Chihuahuas were bred for food and sacrifice. That's why they're all shaky and they're little demons.
And yeah, they're scared.
And Zelato dogs were proud protectors.
Different archetypes.
But yeah, what else?
What was that?
Oh, sorry.
I just said the dogs. Those are different archetypes for dogs.
Right. So, yeah, my dad was always a lover of Chihuahuas, and I could never understand it because, you know, you can't go up and pet these things because they just it's flashing teeth and slobber all the time. There's nothing there because, you know, come and give me a hug.
No. Well,
if you look into what happened to them for hundreds and hundreds of years, it makes sense. They were pretty much, their best job they had was a foot warmer. Their worst job was sacrificing, and then they ate them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then the other dogs in the street were being pet and loved. And
poor guys.
So I guess that creates a generational complex.
Yeah, I think it's still going on.
There's some generational trauma going on there.
Absolutely.
When you look in their eyes, you can just see thousands of Chihuahuas burning at the sacrifice altar.
Oh, my gosh.
What happened?
Yeah, I know.
I think they're good. They're a good old person dog most of the time because they normally bond with one person.
Mm-hmm.
So and they get really lovey-dovey to one person. They're a good old person dog. Sorry, Ron. What do you want to talk about?
I want to know what a Chihuahua tastes like now.
How did we get here?
I don't know.
He's losing it over here. He's losing it.
How do we get to Peking? All right, Ron, what do you want to talk about now? You're up.
You know what? You guys have me stymied right now. We can go any route you want to go to now. I I'm fascinated about the Chihuahua stuff and everything else. So, yeah.
I did have a, like, your opinion, because we just talked about this recently on our show about, and our, at our event we had, just people asking, you know, general questions about Bigfoot. You know, what is it? You mentioned, like, flesh and blood and stuff earlier, or it the other thing, you know, whatever that is. What do you think, like, through your research and stuff, kind of how do you break down Bigfoot?
What do you think Bigfoot is?
So I think Bigfoot, from its very beginning, from its very inception as an archetype, has always been seen as something that straddles two worlds, both the mundane and the miraculous. Mm. You know, so I'm going to say, gentlemen, on this show, unequivocally, that I do believe that what we call Bigfoot, what we call Sasquatch, actually belongs to the realm of the elemental. And I think whenever you talk about Bigfoot, you essentially are talking about the fairy realm. I really do believe that. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a natural, sentient spirit of the natural world. And we can, you know, always go into the idea of the Gaia theory as well. But I think that it's part of our world. It's an emanation from the world itself. And it might actually only be an intelligent energy that is in some way able to manipulate the way we see the world around us. And in that case, it might only be, you know, an orb of energy, you know, witnessed at any time. Maybe that's why we don't have photographs. Maybe that is the reason why we don't have bodies. And because what we're witnessing is not only a product of our imagination, but it's a projection of the other into us.
Mm. Oh, I really like that. That's one of the better explanations of that type of side of Bigfoot 100%. That I've heard. Yeah.
No, and I've said elemental, and we've done a lot of, not nearly as much as you ever, but you know, we've done a lot of research into the Fae culturally across the planet, comparing, and we use Fae as a general term for these same type of entities from Africa and China and the U.S. and in Europe, you know, they're all the same thing. When you really break down the legends and boil it down, they're all talking about roughly the same background character mm-hmm. through human history. I was just going to say, I 100% agree with you that we kind of do it, what it, Bigfoot, we kind of put Bigfoot into three categories, and I think the elemental, the forest fae, is one of our big ones, mm-hmm. personally. Like we've done a lot of fae research talking about, like, they will, like you were talking about, project what image you want back at you, essentially. So if you're going out in the woods and you really want to see Bigfoot and you encounter a fae or an elemental, that's the background, that's what they're going to bounce back at you to see. Mm-hmm. So that, like you said, I love how you explain it. Like, well, that's why you don't, when you take a picture, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it's a blob squatch, or, you know, the orbs are always around them.
Yeah, but the orb thing, I was reading a book by Mike Quast. It was about just a property up in Minnesota, and this guy had been documenting and researching all on his property, all of the weird stuff he had seen happen or just experienced. But one account, he talked about seeing an actual portal open up in his woods, and he said he described it as like an orange rectangle kind of opened, but out of it came two orbs. And they were both orange in the same color. And he said one of the orbs then turned into, like, from that ball of energy into a Bigfoot creature. But it still had that orange glow to it. And then as it continued on, you know, the orange kind of faded away. But there it was. And he said the other orb was still following it around. But then when it came back,
yes.
He watched it and it went back through the portal. And then the portal was gone. But that one always stuck with me reading that account, just knowing, or him witnessing it, and the color, like it maintained the color of the orb, you know, initially when it switched.
Yeah. Hmm. Right. So that's an awesome, awesome point. In my newest book, which will be released on Halloween of all times.
Ooh.
It's being published by Small Town Monster Press, and it's called Lights from the Mist. And it is my research into earth lights, or fairy lights, or spook lights, or whatever you want to call them. Again, they appear all over the world, just like you said. The Australians have it with part of their dream time. Their cultural religion. Yep. You have in, you know, Hindu religion, the prana, which is this this enlivening light, this divine energy. So is it possible that what we call, you know, the paranormal, fairies or whatever, is simply the earth itself responding to us, you know, responding to the species that operates within the world itself as well? I like the idea that from the very beginning, and across all cultures, fairies were always seen as the other, right? Another group separate from us. And if you would look, you know, at the Lord of the Rings, and it's kind of like, you know, Middle Earth, right? You have a whole bunch of different types of creatures coinciding. But is it possible that at one time there were, you know, these beings that kind of shared the same evolutionary lineage as we do, and we interacted with them, and they're still out there, but as we became more sophisticated and more civilized, we left that world behind? And whenever we talk about elementals and we talk about fairies, we also have to talk about things like vibrations and frequencies and sound, because that all makes up that world. And wouldn't it be something if that universal tone is still out there, that very beginning tuning fork that you hit, and it has that resonance that goes throughout all time and space? You know, I do believe that is still occurring in the world around us. I think it's out there in the woods. I think that there are still entities that are part of that world, and we as humans have decided to step out of it. Yeah. We were not expelled from it. We decided that was no longer part of our world. And once we started to put up walls and we put up, you know, fences, all that stuff now becomes the things of the liminal zone, or the things of the deep woods. It becomes something that is feared because it's outside of our knowledge mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. Whenever we were hunter-gatherers, we depended upon that interaction with, you know, the unknown, for so many purposes, agricultural purposes, no one to plant and everything like that. But now in our pridefulness, we've decided that we are too good for that. And I think that when we go into the natural world, sometimes we hit that vibrational frequency, and the other that's still out there, we experience that. We are witnessing it. We are able to see it. And I think that sometimes that could be seen almost as a gift, because I would love to have the opportunity to see through that veil that separates us between us and them now.
Absolutely.
I guess it depends on who you get.
Oh, I guess you're right.
About half of my encounters I'd never want to get.
You see through that veil, and then there's a dog man. Like,
I was thinking the shadow people. Or that was the one that I didn't sleep for. I still don't sleep well.
Yeah.
But I love how you describe it. I was going to ask, are you pretty, you're not, you didn't used to have like a lot of long flowing hair, did you?
No, I wish I did. If I did, I'd still have it. I would never have cut it.
No, I was just going to say, because you sound a lot like me sometimes, just talking about some of this stuff, because it's the same things we've talked about, and it's amazing to hear in all your years of research that you've kind of come on to much more advanced, but the, you know, similar threads.
Right, yeah. It's different than, you know, the typical researchers 100%. Out there, for sure. And I really think it resonates with our listeners of our show, you know, just having that different approach, but then a wide-angled lens towards everything. But I just really like the way you describe things and the history of it all, too, because it all plays a role. You know, they're all points that you can use to connect all these dots, and you got it. Using all of them is very, very important, in my opinion.
One more thing.
It is. Oh, it sorry. Is. It also connects us too, I think, as human beings. Mm-hmm. It shows that, you know, through all of our turmoil and our strife and our stress and our fighting, that we are actually so much more similar than we are allowing ourselves to admit. And I think that, you know, this could bring us together as well too, when we know that we share this world with not only other human beings, but so many different other types of intelligences. You know, I think that is a sad commentary, you know, where we destroy everything rather than saving anything.
Once again, worked in endangered species. Mm-hmm. 100%.
Yeah. It's just the disconnect we all have with the natural world now. And, you know, we're kind of born into it rather
than take your kids out to the woods.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care if it's one of those ones with the walking path and all. It doesn't matter. Just to get your kids out there and connect with nature in some way, shape, or form.
And it's just crazy how fast, you know, the world can change. You know, just since World War II, it's changed so much. But then the technology on top of it changes our lives
110
completely.
Years we didn't fly.
And yeah, and ways that we think, you know, it can be easily viewed as being better. But in reality, you know, we need to step back and zoom back out and get back to what's more natural.
Yeah. So I have 5 kids, and that's how I've always sorted them out. Ever since they were, you know, being carried around, I would have them out in the woods. And I taught for a number of years as well, too. And I always included nature as part of the curriculum, because what it teaches you to do is respect the world around you, show that you can also impact the world around you if you're not careful. You can do a negative impact on the world or beneficial. It's your choice. And the other thing is, and probably the most important thing, it fosters stewardship and responsibility for the world around you as well, 100%. Too. The world is a garden, right? So what we plant right now is for, not for ourselves so much, but for future generations. Mm-hmm. We are living off of what the generations before us have planted. And as we can see, things got screwed up a little bit. But you have children, I have children. So my greatest hope is that we allow them to have a garden in which they can leave to their next generation as well.
100%. I mean, gave me goosebumps just talking about it. Yep. It's very important.
We're pro-garden, we're anti-concrete jungle.
Unless somebody like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing will get better. It simply will not. Roughly the Lorax quote.
That's right. You're right. And I'll have to make this point as well, too. In that garden, I hope there's still fairies.
You're right. I don't think they're going away.
I know we're pretty much out of time for tonight, because me and Jay are on a time crunch tonight. Ron, we're definitely going to have you back on. One thing I want to come, and when you come back on, I would love for us to kind of get into the discussion about paranormally endangered.
Oh, okay.
That's something I've been going on about for forever, but for like the last couple months, really hard.
Yeah, but Ron would be a great one.
I don't want to start it right now because I know we're going to do an easy hour on
that,
on paranormally endangered.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ron, you've been amazing. I didn't even realize it's, I mean, it's been, it flew by. It really did.
It flew by.
If you're open to it, we're going to go ahead. Yep. After we hang up here in a minute, we're going to schedule you for November, because I want you right back on.
Let's do this. Yeah, let's do this.
I just want everyone listening, you know, support Ron. Check out his books. Because I really think he aligns with our audience and, you know.
100%. Just
us in general.
Yeah. And then.
I also wrote a book on fairies as well, too. I want to let you guys know. And I try to trace some of the similarities between cryptids out there as well as fairy lore.
Buy them all.
There you go. Make a great Christmas present.
I know. Ron's box set.
Oh.
Ron, so thank you for coming on. Before we wrap it up here in a second, I do want to say you've been an amazing guest, and we cannot wait to have you back on.
Because
the next time we have you back on, I'm going to guess I'm going to schedule about 3 hours. Just like I'm going to block it off.
Well, I've been a fan since I first met you guys. And I will tell you, it was an honor to be on here with you. So I'm looking forward to the next time.
Well, be prepared to be a repeat guest. But go ahead and tell everybody at home, once again, everybody at home, I always put the links at the top of the description for these guys' stuff. But please support Ron. I mean, I literally, during this episode, I think I bought 2 of his books. And I bought them at festivals and stuff before, too. But I want to make sure I have 2 for certain episodes coming out soon.
Right. You got to get the box set.
But Ron, please go through of how these people can contact you, how to get a hold of you, and where they can buy your stuff.
Okay, sure. So go to Amazon, Ronald L. Murphy Jr., Facebook as well, too. The same thing, Ronald L. Murphy Jr. And I'll tell you, my email address is also ronaldlmurphyjr@yahoo.com. Feel free to drop me a line if you want something from me, a book or anything. I can, you know, send it out there. I'm going to autograph it for you or whatever. But I would like to also just talk. If you have something to say, I would love to hear from you guys.
Absolutely.
All right. We have a tradition here, Ron. I'm going to count down from 3. We're all going to scream bye, and the outro will play. Are you ready? All right.
Well, I'm ready.
3, 2, 1. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Thank you for listening to Crib is the Corn Podcast. Remember, the best way to support the show is share it with a friend. But if you are craving more of the J clones
and more from Mr. E,
there's always extra content on Patreon
and our paid member space on cryptidsofthecorn.com.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting, fun, and informative information.
Bye! Bye.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.